Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments lined up tonight. First, in a few minutes, we'll be speaking with a couple of folks who are involved with the movie King Korn, which will be broadcasting on PBS next week, I believe Tuesday night. We'll have the director, Aaron Wolf, in the studio, and on the phone, the born-again corn farmer, Ian Cheney, who is one of the cast members in the movie. And then at the bottom of the hour, interview recorded earlier this week with a frequent guest on this show, Anatole Lieben, talking mostly about NATO expansion. What is the U.S. up to? Why is the Bush administration so insistent on expanding the membership of NATO to include now Ukraine and Georgia? And what's that all about? Is it just is it a plan to sell weapons contracts, or is it something more strategic than that? Anatole Lieben will answer those questions and several others as well. Before we get to all that, some comments on the news. First of all, for many decades, doctors were among the most adamant opponents of a national health insurance system. The AMAO was likened to socialism, which was bad, of course. That has been changing. How much it's been changing may be a bit of a surprise. A brief article by Aaron Carroll and Ronald Ackerman of the Indiana University School of Medicine, published in Annals of Internal Medicine, a leading medical journal, reports that 59% of doctors recently surveyed support legislation to establish what the authors call a national health insurance system. That's up 10 percentage points over the last 5 years. More supported achieving the goal through incremental reform rather than a sudden transformation, which is disappointing, but it does mean that a historic enemy of a rational and humane health care financing system has turned into a major ally. I said earlier that that result may be a bit of a surprise, but considering the way the insurance industry now interferes with all aspects of medical care, forcing doctors to jump through all kinds of hoops in order to care for their patients, it's probably not really that much of a surprise. But this is one of a few things about American politics that is actually possible to be rather optimistic about. In less upbeat news, a new study jointly produced by the Economic Policy Institute and the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, two institutions that have been frequent suppliers of guests for this program, takes a close look at income distribution at the state level and finds most regions of this country sharing in the national trends towards ever greater inequality. The incomes of the rich have been rising, with those of the middle and lower ranks have barely been heading up at all. In fact, the polarization has actually accelerated since the end of the 1990s. Not much of a surprise, because as I've pointed out here many times, this was the most class-lopsided economic expansion of the 11 since the end of World War II. And the past tense is, of course, the right way to describe that economic expansion, because we are now almost certainly in a recession. Income disparities did not narrow in any of the 50 states in the early years of this decade and widened in 37 of them. They widened most significantly in Alabama, California, Florida, Illinois, Mississippi, Missouri, New Mexico, and Texas, that is the South and the Southwest mostly. The biggest winners in the income sweepstakes were the very upper reaches of the distribution, the top 5%. Unfortunately, this study was based on census data, which doesn't break things down any finer than that. But we do know from other sources that the higher you go up the income ladder, the bigger the gain. And I do mean the higher up you go. If you go up to the top 0.1%, they've been really raking it in. The reasons behind these trends are familiar. Widening wage and salary inequality, the source of most ordinary folks' income, the erosion of the value of the minimum wage, a very important support for those at the bottom, and the rising importance of investment income, which goes mainly to the rich. And, of course, there's a general erosion in social spending, a trend established for several decades now. According to the latest data, New York was the most unequal state in the country, if you compare the top 20% to the bottom 20%. Next in this scroll of shame came Alabama, Mississippi, and Massachusetts. Connecticut was 7th and California 8th. For more, visit the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities website at cbpp.org. That's CBPP, as in Center for Budget and Policy Priorities.org. Continuing the trend of downbeat news, there continues to be little doubt the U.S. economy is in recession. On Friday, the 4th of April, we learned that employers shed 80,000 jobs in March, the third consecutive monthly loss. On Thursday morning, the 10th, the Labor Department reported a sharp decline in the number of first-time claimants for unemployment insurance, following a very sharp increase the previous week. But these weekly numbers can be very volatile. They do bounce around a lot from week to week. The best measure is a four-week moving average of these series, which smooths out all that bouncing around, and that continues to creep higher. The general picture is of an eroding but not collapsing economy. I suspect that we're going to see more of this in the coming months. It's a comfort that it's eroding rather than collapsing, but on the other hand, I don't see much in the horizon that's going to turn things around anytime soon. Heavy debts and falling house prices continue to weigh on the U.S. economy, and those things aren't going to go away anytime soon. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we will be back to speak about corn.
Bought myself a farm way out in the country. Took to growing lettuce, milk, and counting honey. Bought myself a farm
way out in the country.
Bought myself a farm way out in the country. Spent time in the hayloft with my mice and my bunny. Spent time in the country. Yes, it's good living on the farm. Also good. Coming down the road, he always looks so regal, riding on a road. He likes it. The toad's mane is lightning, his head hangs out the shoulder. And if you give him sugar, you know he'll whinny like a boner. Yes, he will. Yes, it's good living on the farm. Also good.
And we're back. We're now joined in the studio by Aaron Wolf, who is the director of the movie King Corn. And on the phone, joining us from somewhere out there in the heartland, is Ian Cheney, who is an associate producer and a born-again corn farmer. Welcome to you, Aaron Wolf. Your movie's going to be on PBS on Tuesday, right, the April 15th?
It is. Here in New York, it's going to be broadcast actually on the 18th at 10 p.m., but nationally it's one of those check local listings.
Check your local listings. But sometime next week it will be available for viewing. And we have Ian Cheney on the line also joining us from somewhere out there in the heartland, right? Welcome, Ian.
Yes, thanks. I'm in Chicago, Illinois.
Oh, okay. Well, that's the urban heartland, not not the heartland of good soil and good values. Tell us how you got this idea of farming a patch of earth. You got the idea of going out there, farming an acre of Iowa and raising some corn. How this come to be?
Well, I kind of got the idea from Ian, so I think I'm going to let him take this question.
Well, I got the idea from Aaron. No, when Curtis and I, when my best friend and Aaron's cousin, Curtis and I, graduated from college, we were very curious about where our food came from. And in talking with Aaron about the idea of making a film about where our food came from, Aaron sent me and Kurt out to research our food system as best we could in a beat-up car with a few bucks across the country. And what we found was not only that the entire landscape and so much of our food landscape was either covered in corn or made out of corn, but also that Curtis and I had family roots in the same Iowa county. And I think when Aaron heard that, he in particular was really excited about this idea of moving to Iowa ourselves and not only exploring corn, but also exploring our family roots in corn and kind of taking ownership of this crop that seemed to have a lot to do with where our food system was heading.
And I neglected to identify that piece of music we heard introducing this segment, which is the Jefferson Airplanes, The Farm, an ironic take of the Battle of the Land movement from the late 1960s. You also found, though, at the beginning of the film, you show a hair sample being taken, and much of your body is actually ultimately made of corn, isn't it?
I was going to say I'm a lot more familiar with Jefferson Airplane, or I certainly was, than I was with corn and farming before we began this project. And, you know, Ian expressed it really well, that what I was looking for from a filmmaking standpoint was a narrative in. How do you make a story about corn at all interesting or intriguing to watch?
Watching corn grow is proverbial dullness itself, isn't it?
Yes, axiomatic for boring.
Yes.
And made it very hard to raise money for this project. But, as we began to look into the story, so many things emerged. And the question you just brought up, this idea that the carbon in our bodies actually originates from corn. There's a way of taking your hair and putting it in a mass spectrometer, which is a machine that measures various levels of isotopes And carbon has a unique, corn has a unique signature, this C4 carbon. And so you can really identify how much of your body mass actually came from corn. And it's amazing how high the figures are. We recently were on Good Morning America, and even Diane Sawyer is 50% corn.
That's not necessarily hard to believe. But but when someone is described as corn-fed, that's not just a sign of heartland wholesomeness, but it's even we urbanites are heavily made out of corn. Of course, it's not that we eat a lot of corn in the cob that produces this result, right?
But that's something we didn't really know. You know, driving across the country, you can imagine that there's got to be a lot of 4th of July barbecues to use up all that corn, but of course, that's not sweet corn that we're growing out there, and nor are those, you know, edamame that the soybean fields are producing. The corn we grow is this basically inedible commodity crop that's designed to basically be processed into food. It can only be eaten if it's processed either into high fructose corn syrup or into a myriad number of multisyllabic food ingredients that we see in the average grocery store product, or corn-fed beef, which is a really big one.
Yeah, I want to return to all that in a little bit, but let's talk about the process of growing corn. Now, farming is not a field a lot of people are entering these days, except maybe if you're making a movie, but how'd you go about setting yourselves up with your acre out there in Iowa?
Well, we called our Corn Growers Association and asked if they knew any farmers who might be crazy enough to let a couple of East Coast college kids tromp around on their farm for a year. And they gave us a number of farmers, and one of them, Chuck Pyatt, in the town of Green, where my great-grandfather grew up, you know, took the bait. And he and his neighbor, Rich Johnson, who was actually farming Chuck's land, they both took us under their wings and showed us how the modern corn farm works. We picked out 1 acre that sat in the middle of a, must have been a 10-acre cornfield that itself sat in the middle of a sea of corn in this little town of Green. And we planted, fertilized, sprayed, and harvested that corn exactly as all of the other neighboring corn farmers did.
And someone in the movie, I believe it should look like some kind of local beauty queen or something, says that Iowa could supply the entire United States with corn. Is that a bit of local patriotism, or is that really true?
It's really true. What we've gotten very good at doing is growing an awful lot of corn in a small amount of space. And particularly in a place like Iowa, which has some of the richest soil in the world, we do it to fabulous success, if success be measured by quantity.
Yeah, now I believe somebody in the film says that if you were going to pick an ideal patch of earth for producing corn, Iowa would be it. What is it about Iowa that makes it so corn-friendly?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is Iowa has some of the richest topsoil on the earth. A lot of that topsoil, since we plowed the prairie, has been running downstream down the Mississippi as the soil erodes from our intensive agriculture practices, but still the soil is incredibly rich there. It's also, you know, it's in an area known as the humid prairie, and corn really likes hot, humid summer days. And so corn really thrives in Iowa. Corn is a grass plant. It's kind of a giant grass plant with these giant grass seeds. But the humid prairie for thousands of years was the home of native grasses, and so corn, a grass that originated in southern Mexico where it didn't have as much moisture and didn't have as rich soils, kind of just went bonkers when it got to Iowa, and it grows really well there.
Now, I'm a true urbanite, and I know next to nothing about farming. Watching your film doubled my knowledge of agriculture, and maybe more than that. But you arrived in the early winter, I guess in January. What do you do in the winter months when there's snow in the ground?
Well, the first thing you do, we learned, is you sign up for government subsidies. The first act in the farming season is to go in and sign up for the government program. And until very recently, it was impossible to have a profitable corn operation unless you collected that government check at the end.
Now, of course, corn prices are way up, as are most agricultural commodities over the last couple of years. There was one day a couple weeks ago when rice prices rose by 30% just in a single day, and corn is up, 85 or 100% over the last several months. If you were making the movie now, it would be a rather different story, wouldn't it?
It might be. You know, the movie makes a point by saying that for so long we subsidized corn to create this chronic glut of healthy harvests and a real overproduction, in a sense. We then made food products that were produced for less than the price of producing the corn, and the government picked up the tab for the difference. And what that did is it created a food infrastructure that really, in which the government subsidized the raw ingredients for some of our least nutritious foods. At the same time as America was having a growing epidemic of obesity and other diet-related diseases such as heart failure and type 2 diabetes, we were subsidizing the raw ingredients for the foods that were implicated in those diseases.
Now, there's a fundamental economic problem, which is that modern farming is almost too productive for its own good, isn't it?
Well, you know, the qualities that we've always selected, to go back to your questions about agriculture, have been those of quantity, of productivity, as opposed to other considerations. Just like in the world of produce, we often select for shelf life or appearance over things like flavor and nutrition. We all know what it's like to see a beautiful tomato or apple at the market and then take a bite of it and it tastes like sawdust. It's because we haven't chosen for those qualities. In commodity agriculture, we've chosen for volume instead of other desirable things like nutrition or soil preservation, as Ian was pointing out.
And as I think Michael Pollan points out in the film, it's not that the plant has changed so much. They're just squeezed really close together now, aren't they?
Well, that was one strategy for getting more. But, you know, genetic modification is another strategy for getting more. Hybridization is another strategy for getting more. 64-row planters is another strategy for getting more.
And so to go back to the process, you arrive in January, sign up for government payments, which amounted to, what was it, $28 for an acre? And then what do you do? After you, that probably doesn't take an awful long time to sign up for your government check. So what do you do for the next few months?
Well, for us, during the next few months, we kind of learned about our family histories and learned about, part of the process of being out there was trying to understand how the modern corn farm came to be, and it turned out that our family histories were very much involved in creating the modern corn farm. Kurt's great-grandfather owned the company that built the first tractor. My great-grandfather also grew up on a farm, and so we spent a couple months understanding, well, how is it that this modern farm came to be, and, you know, why did farmers choose bigger tractors and choose herbicides and choose to fertilize their acres? And so by the time April came around and we were ready to inject anhydrous ammonia fertilizer into our soil, we understood why, which was, for not very much work and not very much money, we were going to get a heck of a lot more corn than our great-grandfathers ever could have grown.
A lot of people have been leaving the land since, like, forever. There was a time when almost all of us were working the farms, and now almost none of us do. What is it like out there in places like Greene, Iowa? How many people live there? Are the buildings deserted? Are there ghost towns? What's it like?
Well, Greene, you know, has got a population of about 1,000 people, and it's a relatively well-off town and compared to many other towns in the region. Part of the reason is it's far enough away from the nearest Walmart to mean that its mom and pop businesses on Main Street still operate if not thrive. But, you know, while we were there in Greene, a lot of significant things happened in the town's history. The old grain elevator was burned down because it simply wasn't big enough to handle these gigantic yields that were coming off the cornfields. And the high school, too, another detail that we filmed but didn't make it into the movie, had to consolidate, had to close down for lack of students. You know, there's football teams in rural Iowa that have 6 or 7 people on a side now because of a lot of the same things that are going on, have gone on with our food system, I think are connected to these towns. And the same subsidies that promote a system of low margins and high productivity mean that you really can't be successful as a farmer unless you've got a really big operation. And that means less people. It means more efficiency. It means, yes, some people can leave the towns if they want to. But I think what we're seeing is – a lot of people that want to farm and can't. And it was a huge revelation for me to go out there, and I think for all of us, to see that the health of our food system and the healthiness of our foods seem to be connected to the healthiness of our rural communities as well.
That's the voice of Aaron Wolf, who is the director of the film King Corn, and on the line speaking to us from Chicago is Ian Cheney, one of the amateur farmers in the movie. So was there a lot of work involved in this farming, or are you just like, use a machine to stick seeds in the ground and sit back and wait for them to grow?
Well, it was a different type of work than we envisioned. You know, I think we went out there expecting...
You're not getting up at 5:30 and plowing the fields.
Right. We didn't have to do a lot of, you know, down on hands and knees, weeding by hand and so forth. Most of the work, as we understood it in our year out there, is largely most of the manual labor is taken care of by really big, impressive machines that often have GPS guidance systems and CD players and air conditioning. And, you know, a lot of the work, therefore, is either done at the computer, understanding the markets or filling out your subsidy forms or researching different herbicide packages that you might use, researching the seeds that you might use to maximize your yield, or repairing the machines. There's farming has become, you know, very complicated. So it's not to say that there's not a lot of work. There just didn't seem to be a lot of sweat.
All right, I want to leap ahead a bit and get to the harvest season. You, as I recall, the numbers were it cost you about $350 to raise your acre. You cleared about $330 for it, and that means you lost 20 just on the pure market basis. So the government subsidy made up all the difference?
Yeah, the government subsidy for a long time was the difference between profit and loss. As you've pointed out, corn prices and many commodity prices have had an unprecedented rise in recent months. Some of that has to do with the ethanol craze. Some of that has to do with a growing middle class in developing countries that have a greater demand for the raw ingredients for some of these processed foods. And a lot of it has to do with the input costs. You know, petroleum has gone up so much, and the way we farm today is so contingent upon, you know, huge doses of fossil fuels in various forms. Ian mentioned before the anhydrous ammonia that we put in to fertilize the field. That's atmospheric nitrogen, but it's cracked with natural gas. All that traction, all that diesel to run those giant machines that Ian was talking about, all of which, you know, is very fuel intensive. And really goes to show how much we have built an agriculture and a food system that's contingent upon a ready supply of cheap fuel. And one of the points that, you know, has come up a lot in the discussions of the film is we really need to begin to envision an agriculture and food system for a diminishing petroleum society.
Yeah, and in the time remaining, I do want to concentrate on this product, because, you know, there's a scene when the harvest comes in and you taste the corn, and it's it seems pretty revolting. It's not that kind of sweet, perfect corn that an urbanite imagines you'd pick off off the stalk. What happens with that inedible corn?
Well, that corn, which didn't taste great in the field, is actually an incredibly useful product for an industrialized food system. It's almost entirely starch, and so it can be broken down and reshaped into any number of things, whether it's whether it heads down the railroad tracks to the corn refinery, where it can be processed into the very sweet and ubiquitous product, high fructose corn syrup, which then gets shipped off by rail in a tanker car to turn into any number of processed foods at your corner convenience store.
Amazing. Factoid, 20,000 acres of corn produces Brooklyn's annual soda supply, right?
Yes, and, you know, the average American consumes over 70 pounds of high-fructose corn syrup every year. So as we point out in the film, though our consumption of table sugar, of cane sugar, has gone down since the 1970s, our consumption of high fructose corn syrup has gone up so much that we now consume, on average, as Americans, 30% more sweeteners than we did just 35, 40 years ago. And And much of that has been made possible by the fact that corn has been a really cheap, malleable raw material. By far the largest chunk of the corn crop, though, ends up as feed for livestock. We followed our corn to cattle feedlots, which are in large part a product of our policy of cheap corn, because corn has been so cheap, it's been almost economically irresistible for people who raise cattle to fatten their cattle on corn, because corn makes cattle fatter much quicker than if they were out grazing on grass.
And I was surprised to learn they weren't really built to eat all that corn, so it makes for very fat cows and ultimately fat people because of soda. So this is a gigantic obesity machine, isn't it?
It sure is. Seems like a good place to look if you're going to be looking into why Americans have gotten so fat so quickly. And you know, this film was really meant to look into one possible route. And I think you keep bringing up the high food prices now, and I think that's really important. In some ways, we had such cheap corn for so long that we yoked ourselves to a system. Farms in the Midwest are designed to plant corn. Government commodities continue to encourage that planting, even with high prices. Elevators are designed to store corn. Rail cars are designed to transport corn syrup. So even though we ironically now are starting to have higher prices, we have the same food system. So in some ways, we're having the worst of both worlds. We're having less high-quality foods and higher prices. And yet, I do think there may be a silver lining to all of this. If we can begin to have foods that are locally produced become cheaper because of the input costs to commodity growing, because it costs so much to transport that stuff from Iowa to New York, I think that we ironically may end up with healthier foods being cheaper. If you go to the grocery store now, a New York apple is going to look that much more appealing than a bottle of soda if those input costs for the soda have gone way up.
And yeah, it's a system that was designed around cheap inputs and massive quantities, which had to be absorbed. I mean, the whole fructose thing, high fructose corn syrup, wasn't part of a scheme for absorbing all this surplus corn production, was it?
Yeah, it's high fructose corn syrup was invented by the Japanese in the late 60s, and by some Japanese. And, you know, it really took hold in the U.S., as Michael Pollan suggests, as a disposal strategy, as a way of getting rid of all that corn. And now we're really yoked to a food system that depends on it. And as Ian points out, you know, we eat so much more of this sweetener now per capita per year that, just like happens with salt intake, I have this feeling that our baseline sense of what is sweet has changed. We have to add that much more sweetener to things to have them feel sweet, because things like yogurt and bread and hamburger buns have this high fructose corn syrup in them, so we don't taste them as sweet. They're just kind of part of the food, you know, neutral ground, and we add more and more sweetener onto things that would have been, to our grandparents, terribly sweet to begin with.
Well, as William Blake said, the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom, but I think this may be an exception. Thanks to both of you. We're out of time. That was the last voice you heard was that of Aaron Wolf, the director of the movie King Corn, and on the line joining us from Chicago, Ian Cheney, one of the farmers in the film. And you can see King Corn this week, or next week, rather, on PBS stations across the country. Check your local listings. And you have a website for the film, too, right?
We do. It's kingcorn.net. And you can look at some of the ways in which legislation affects corn policy, and you can find the DVD available there. It's also available in wide release from Docurama DVDs beginning April 29th.
All right, thanks to both of you. Good luck with the movie, and let's take a station break, and we will be back.
W-B-A-I, 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 New York, New York.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
This is WBAI, not only at 99.5 on your FM dial in New York, but on the web at WBAI.org. Please be sure to check out that website frequently. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Anatole Levin. That a little bit of the New Zealand band Dial, their song If You're Not Battling, from their MySpace page. And that was recommended to me by someone who listens to this show, a union organizer down in New Zealand who is also a big punk rock fan. So check it out. And this show does indeed have a worldwide audience, which is an immensely gratifying thing. All right, now, an interview recorded the other day with Anatole Levin, who is a professor of war studies at King's College London. Prolific author and frequent guest on this show, and I got the idea of calling him because I was really mystified what this NATO expansion was all about. So, interview recorded a couple of days ago, Anatole Levin. Welcome, Anatole Levin. First of all, it looks like George Bush rediscovered some of the magic in Vladimir Putin's eyes in their recent meeting. What do you make of it?
Well, I don't think he discovered much, much magic, really. They've come to a pragmatic arrangement or the beginning of one on certain issues, but on other critical issues, notably NATO expansion and Kosovo, they remain very far apart indeed.
Okay, let's talk about some of those issues then. What do you think is the logic behind NATO expansion? What is the U.S. trying to accomplish? There's a school of thought in the American left that it's all about Lockheed Martin lobbying for weapons contracts. That seems a little vulgar and reductionist to me. Well, what's the strategy in your estimation?
Well, I wouldn't, I must say, describe it as a strategy. I don't think it's well thought through at all in terms either of American interests or American power. But there are a number of different forces and calculations behind it. One calculation is to maintain and strengthen NATO as a vehicle for American power in Europe and also as an important ally of the United States in the war on terror. Another motive is to try to spread free market democracy in Eurasia by bringing it to Ukraine, Georgia, and other places after that. Then there is the desire of George Bush for some kind of historical legacy. And clearly, he sees the expansion of NATO as part of that. And then there are various ethnic and political lobbies in America who are deeply hostile to Russia, either for national reasons or because of the legacy of the Cold War. So you have all of these different factors coming together, I think.
Well, if you put yourselves in the Russian shoes, it looks like the U.S. is trying to surround them and contain the renaissance of Russian power. Is there anything to that interpretation?
Well, yes, there's a lot to it. And from the Russian point of view, of course, it's an attempt to remove completely from Russian influence a country, Ukraine, which was part of Russia for centuries and has a Russian minority of about 20%. In addition, a large majority of whose population don't want NATO membership. They actively oppose it, in part precisely because they desire to keep close relations with Russia. And in the case of Georgia, it's NATO and the United States taking sides with a country which is in a state of frozen war with minorities who are backed by Russia. So as the Russians see it, it's very much the Kosovo syndrome in reverse. And finally, of course, the Russians say with some reason that if any other major power or alliance of powers tried to behave in this way in Central America and the Caribbean, the Americans would, the United States would probably go to war in response. So, you know, obviously from the Russian point of view, this is extremely provocative, and they are determined to oppose it. The question is how far they will go in opposing it.
But it would look like if somehow Russia and Georgia, say, ever came to war, NATO expansion would require the U.S. to come to the defense of Georgia. Does that make any sense? Could you imagine a world in which that would happen?
Well, no, I can't. Although, I suppose, under a McCain presidency, it's conceivable that the United States might actually get involved in a war on Georgia's side. But it's very hard to imagine. And that is why I have to say... one of the reasons why it seems to be that NATO enlargement is such a bad idea, because if the Russians choose to call our bluff, or if Georgia starts a war in the hope that we will support them, we're heading both for a major geopolitical disaster and a very serious international humiliation. Because the overwhelming likelihood is that we wouldn't fight. The Georgians would be defeated, and NATO would be made to look shamefully impotent.
It seems like NATO is one of these post-World War II institutions, rather like the Bretton Woods institutions, that's kind of, I don't know, obsolete or flailing about without a mission. What is the point of NATO in 2008?
Well, the great justification for NATO in the 1990s was... that it eventually, very belatedly, helped bring peace to the former Yugoslavia, although it was, of course, I mean, above all, American power that did that. The second justification was said to be that it contributed to the democratization and progress of former communist Eastern Europe, although people in America tend to forget that it was the European Union which was really by far the most responsible for that, because it did the really heavy lifting of economic reform, economic subsidies, political, social reform, and so forth. Now to those two, there's a third justification being given, which is NATO's role in the war on terror, and in particularly in the conflict in Afghanistan. But of course, as we saw from Bucharest, it is actually proving extremely difficult to get most of the members of NATO to contribute any serious forces to Afghanistan or to the war on terror in general. So that there are a great many question marks over just how useful NATO is. The final reason for the continuation of NATO is that it is a kind of ultimate fallback position against the possibility of future Russian aggression in Europe. But the problem is that NATO has now got involved in various policies which are by far... the most likely to make such Russian aggression a reality. So that's a kind of circular argument, really.
And what about this mission in Afghanistan? It doesn't seem like that war is going very well or likely to go very well. What is happening there? What's your prognosis?
Well, clearly, America and America's closest allies, Canada and Britain, will fight on for a very considerable time. Whether other NATO allies will contribute really serious forces, or frankly, even if they did, it would make much difference because, you know, the Dutch, for example, are sitting there in Uruzgan in quite considerable numbers, but they are preventing conflict by the, very logical method of not doing any fighting. So whether they're actually doing anything serious, you know, in the context of fighting the Taliban is very questionable. But the most important question is, can we develop a new and much more successful development strategy for strengthening the Afghan state and developing the Afghan economy, above all when it comes to getting the Afghan economy away from dependence on the heroin trade and opium poppy production? If we can, then there is a chance, you know, that we may be able to get out of there at some point in future, although any such strategy would take 20 years at least. To come to fruition. If we can't do that, why then? Either we're going to have to stay in Afghanistan indefinitely for decades and decades, generations to come, or at some stage, Western populations are simply going to lose patience and we're going to pull out whatever state Afghanistan is in.
We're facing some personnel transitions in several major players. First of all, in a couple of weeks, Vladimir Putin will be out of office, and his successor Medvedev will take over. What do you foresee, any major changes in Russian strategy?
No. Both because Putin will remain an extremely powerful and indeed dominant figure, but also because Russian policy is now supported by an overwhelming consensus, both of the Russian establishment and of the Russian population. It simply is not true that there is a strong domestic opposition which opposes present Russian policy on NATO expansion, on Kosovo, on relations with the West in general. It would be very foolish to look for any radical change there. That said, it's clear that Medvedev personally has a moderate character, that he is, his instincts are diplomatic and sensible. And therefore, I think he will not deliberately try to increase crisis or deliberately to worsen relations. And he may try at least to respond diplomatically to Western pressure. But in the end, Russia does not have a great deal of freedom of maneuver because it is determined to oppose certain things that the West is doing. That's not true across the board. I think as we've seen from the latest meeting between Bush and Putin, there is room for maneuver on the question of missile defense for Eastern Europe. And we may see compromise there. There's room for maneuver on certain aspects of relations with Iran, for example. But on NATO expansion, I don't think there's much room for maneuver at all.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of King's College London. What about that missile defense? I mean, the U.S. Excuse is that it's a terror-fighting measure. That seems rather implausible, given the location we're talking about. What do you think? Is this just part of the surround Russia strategy?
Yes. I mean, it's intended to do something to reward the Poles and the Central Europeans. There is a certain justification in fears of Iran, although, as you say, it's pretty implausible. And, of course, this has been a Republican obsession for years, missile defense. And it certainly contributes to the pressure on Russia, although I don't think that an anti-Russian position was actually responsible for this policy. I think other factors led to it.
And to return to the personnel transition issue, you had a piece in the Financial Times recently in which you said that if McCain were to become president, we would look back on the Bush years with nostalgia. What do you mean by that?
Well, I must confess, but on the basis of, well, both talks with people who know McCain well, but also a great deal of reporting in the U.S. media, I am quite worried about the fiery nature, shall we say, of McCain's character and the degree of bellicosity in many of his statements about relations with other countries, notably Russia and Iran. It's not that when it comes to formal policies, he is much tougher than Hillary Clinton, for example, but a president has to be prepared also to react to unexpected events, like, for example, the bringing down of the EP3 reconnaissance aircraft by the Chinese in 2001. My fear, and that of many other people who know McCain, and I don't know him personally, is that in such a crisis, McCain's instinct would be to escalate, to increase the pressure, to increase the rhetoric, potentially leading to very dangerous crises indeed. And given the number of potential crises there are around the world now with so many different states, I must say I would feel safer with a much calmer and less hot-tempered person in the White House. Which, by the way, I think that George Bush, with all his faults, has been on a number of issues, including Russia and China, though not, of course, Iraq or Iran.
And although it seems perhaps a little less likely than a few weeks ago, it does seem more likely than not that a Democrat will take office in January. What kind of departures in American policy do you expect from either candidate, and how much of a difference between the two of them do you see?
Well, if it's Obama, it appears that there will be quite a serious change of policy with regard to the Middle East. You know, the opening of direct talks with the Iranians and the Syrians. Now, what that will lead to is not entirely clear. Obviously, to have real progress with the Iranians will have to get, you know, to replace Ahmadinejad as well. If that were to happen, then I think that substantial progress would be possible. With Syria, it's partly, of course, very largely a question of what the Israelis can be brought to offer to the Syrians. But I think that under Obama, there would be a real chance of a more moderate policy in the Middle East aimed at, you know, creating regional consensus. With regard to Russia, I don't think that policy as such would change very much. Obama's people favor NATO expansion. They support Kosovo, Kosovan independence, and so forth and so on. The question, once again, would be whether, you know, how an Obama administration would behave in a crisis with Russia. And that, I think, will depend very largely on who Obama would appoint to senior positions. I think his own instinct would probably be fairly diplomatic and sensible. But it's you know, it's also a question of who he appoints to, well, to be Secretary of State and to deal with Russia policy. One can imagine people who would take a moderate and pragmatic approach, and others who would be much more likely to take a very hard line approach. We won't really know about that until, well, first of course, if he's elected, and secondly, until, you know, he makes his senior appointments.
What are the possibilities that he would be under tremendous pressure to prove himself reliable to the security establishment and the Zionist lobby?
Well, every U.S. president has to prove himself, you know, to some degree to the Israel lobby. And the Israel lobby has acted, of course, to frustrate, to a great extent, every attempt at peace between Israel and Palestine, or at least at a real American sponsorship of such peace. For many years now. That won't change under Obama. I mean, I don't think it'll get worse, but I don't think it will change. As far as the security establishment in general is concerned, you have to remember that it isn't the U.S. military who have been driving, you know, aggressive and reckless policies in recent years. It's certainly, for example, not the U.S. uniform military who are pushing NATO expansion. Many of them absolutely loathe the idea because, of course, you know, it represents yet more strategic overstretch. So I think it wouldn't necessarily be the case that he would have to go overboard in proving his toughness on given issues. On the other hand, you know, it would be very difficult for any U.S. president to carry out a radical change of course on key issues like NATO expansion, unless, of course, which is always possible, some dramatic new event happens, particularly in the Middle East or in the world economy, which changes, you know, the attitudes of the American establishment in general. One thing we haven't touched on yet is the whole question of how deep the present economic recession will go. And if it does go very deep, what effect this will have on American desire, you know, to take on new international commitments. I think certainly in a deep economic recession, many of the policies which have been taken for granted in recent years might come to seem much more questionable.
And relatedly, I mean, you mentioned the problem of strategic overstretch a little while ago. How serious is that? Has Iraq really broken the U.S. in some kind of military or political sense?
Well, I don't think it's broken the U.S., but the hard fact is it hasn't broken the U.S. military yet. And, of course, America has immense reserves of strength and resilience. But if the U.S. were to undertake another really major military deployment, a long-term military deployment, not, you know, a short-term one like the first Iraq War, that would break the existing U.S. military. There just would not be enough troops for that. At which point, well, then really big questions begin to emerge about America's global position, about whether the American population could conceivably be prepared to accept a reintroduction of the draft in order to create enough troops. One assumes not, though in the context, God forbid, of another really major terrorist attack on America, once again, you know, who knows what might be possible. But, I mean, that is why a lot of people at the Pentagon so dislike the idea of NATO membership for Georgia and Ukraine. Because if, at any stage, that required basically the dispatch of an American army to defend these states, that would be the end of America's, well, I mean, something would have to give. America would have to withdraw, either, you know, withdraw from Iraq or from Afghanistan, or introduce the draft, or wind up its commitment to South Korea, or something, because the troops just wouldn't be there otherwise.
And then finally, just what are U.S. options in Iraq? An Obama advisor's paper was recently leaked suggesting that we'll keep 60 to 80,000 troops there for a number of years. In the campaign, they're talking about withdrawal, but how credible are these promises of withdrawal?
Incredible. I really don't think it's going to happen, partly because the bipartisan foreign and security establishment is dead against it. I mean, they are all committed to American domination of the Middle East, and it does look as if a permanent American presence in Iraq is necessary for that, in the sense that otherwise the place will go to hell and America will be seen as having suffered a very crushing defeat. The key question is whether Iraq can in fact be stabilized. I mean, even to the extremely tenuous degree that it's stable today, with only 60,000 or 80,000 troops, or whether, in fact, America will need to retain almost twice that number as at present, you know, just to keep things as they are. Well, I mean, we've already seen that, you know, Petraeus and the military have now paused, whatever that means, or calling for the pause of the withdrawal. Does pause really mean a brief pause and then resumption, or does pause in fact mean suspension? But I really don't think that Obama will adopt a position of early withdrawal if he's elected. On the other hand, of course, you know, things may happen elsewhere in the world which will simply make it impossible, that will, as I've said, face America with a choice of either basically giving up really important positions elsewhere in the world. And those could, I mean, those could involve, for example, basically shelving NATO expansion, further NATO expansion. But it will be that choice that either you give up points like that, or you just have to withdraw from Iraq because there aren't the troops, or you introduce the draft to raise more troops. And, you know, if that moment ever comes, well, U.S. establishment in general will have some very, very hard decisions to make. I mean, my fear is that it's so difficult by now to make a decision of this kind in Washington because of the number of different, you know, lobbies and pressures at work, that America may make the classic strategic mistake, you know, made by Germany before the First World War and so many other countries historically, of not deciding, of not being able to decide, of going on, you know, doing several different incompatible things at once and eventually losing everywhere. I mean, that's my nightmare, you know, which is one reason why I oppose NATO expansion. I don't want that to happen. But, you know, we're not there yet. But clearly the whole notion of a permanent presence in Iraq does raise that possibility. As you know, and we haven't even talked about growing strategic rivalry with China yet.
All right, that's a topic of another conversation. Okay, thank you very much for joining us, Anatole Lieben.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
We've been listening to Anatole Lieben, who is a professor in the Department of War Studies at King's College London. He is the author, most recently, of America Right or Wrong, An Anatomy of American Nationalism, and a co-author of Ethical Realism, A Vision for America's Role in the World. He is in the early stages of a book on Pakistan. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I'll be back next week. And let's go with this lovely version of Love's Vigilantes, an old New Order song performed by Laura Cantrell, who's a WFMU DJ, as well as being a fine country musician. Till next week. Bye.